The Talk of the Northwest, The Greg Hughes Show on Highland Radio.
Hello and a very good morning, 5 minutes past nine on this Friday, the 6th of February, 2026. You're very welcome along to The Greg Hughes Show. We're here with you for the next couple of hours. We have moved the Friday panel back to Fridays 9 till 10 because we listen to you, OK? And that's where you wanted it and that's where it's at. So it's back permanently now again at 9 to 10. Coming up after 10 o'clock, we have Seamus Gunn joining us to answer all your legal questions, right? So between questions and comments about some of the topics we have over the next hour, 086 60 25,000. That's the WhatsApp and text number, 086 60 25,000, or give us a call on 074 91 25,000, or email comments at highlandradio.com. Let's see who we have today. Councillor Fionnán Bradley, Fianna Fáil and Las Cathaoirleach of the Innishow Municipal District. Máirtín Y. Fionnán, good morning to you.
Morning, Greg, and good morning to my fellow panellists and all your listeners.
Indeed, Emma Gove is one of those, a.k.a. the wee Donegal mammy. How are you getting on, Emma? No, you're muted, Emma. I beg your pardon. Sorry, that's okay.
Sorry, Greg, can you hear me now?
I can hear you loud and clear, indeed. Good morning to you.
Good morning to you, Greg, to the panel and to all your listeners and to those watching on YouTube.
Yep, Seamus McDade's Managing Director of Football Special. He's with us now. Good morning to you, Seamus.
Morning, Greg.
Thanks so much morning, for joining everyone. Us. Fionnán, I'll start with you. We've been covering for 7 days now, effectively, these proposed changes to the PSO schedule at Donegal Airport. For people in Donegal, this flight is not a luxury. It is a lifeline, especially for cancer patients travelling to Dublin for treatment. If the new contract cuts the afternoon flights and makes the same day return almost impossible, hasn't the government basically failed in its duty to provide essential connectivity to the Northwest, Fionnán?
Well, first of all, Greg, I would say that I stand in solidarity with all the cancer patients that have signed the petition. I believe that there are in or around 10,000 signatures on that petition now to have the flight schedule maintained as it currently is. And I also would say that it's not a done deal. I've been speaking to my Raptus colleagues, both Deputy Pat the Cope Gallagher and Minister McConlogue, and work is ongoing in the background to ensure that the proposed changes don't go through, because they would result in phantom flights. In my opinion, where you'll have flights leaving Dublin at maybe 6:30 in the morning with nobody on them, because who's going to be leaving Dublin at 6:30 a.m. to come to Donegal, etc. So a lot of work is ongoing in the background to make sure that the proposed changes don't go through, and I'm hopeful that we'll get a positive resolution and that common sense will prevail, Greg, which is what's needed here now, in my opinion.
Do you think questions need to be asked as to how we find ourselves in this situation? You know, who drew up this tender? No one seems to want to answer that question for me, because in fairness to the preferred airline, they have met the criteria laid out in that tender.
Yeah, well, common sense is lacking. There's no question about that, and questions do have to be asked. I mean, where is the value for money? If we're going to have maybe an increase in the number of flights, or even the same number of flights but at different times with nobody on them, then that is essentially a reduction in service, and there is no value for money. So yeah, there definitely do need to be questions asked about the proposed schedule, and who drew it up, and what consultation or discussions did they have to arrive at the conclusion they arrived at.
How long's Football Special been in business, Seamus?
80 plus years.
Yeah. Do you think a private company like that would last 80 plus years with this type of management of the basics?
Absolutely not. I mean, it is crazy that you're trying to find an answer as to who drew up the tender, and you can't find it out because it's in essence some unnamed civil servant in the Department of Transport who can barely pick Donegal off a map. So, you know, there's no way this would be acceptable in the private sector. And yeah, common sense, you know, there probably is a chance that common sense will prevail, but do we really have to hope that, you know, that this is so obvious that it shouldn't have needed to get to this point?
Yeah, I just, the common sense prevailing, I'm curious as to how that happens, because I'm not sure about tender documents, changing tender documents, amending them. At the end of the day, the airline could say, look, we tendered, this was what was on the table. If you want an extra flight, it's going to be extra money. And I know Deputy Pat the Cope Gallagher said on an interview in this programme, if it requires more money, well, then more money should be forthcoming. But we can't throw money at mistakes either.
Well, no, but it shouldn't. This is a mistake. It shouldn't have happened. You know, there will have to be an overarching review on this and find out why did this happen. You and I, Greg, will never find out. Fiona may find out, but he probably won't as well. You know, I don't even know if Pat the Cope will find out. But somebody internally will say this was a mistake and we need to rectify this. And I have no doubt it will cost the Irish taxpayer more money because, to your point, the airline will say, well, hold on, we need more money for an extra flight, even though in the existing tender it's there. So we'll get a worse deal for the taxpayer. But it shouldn't take the people right now who use the flight for essential services are being put at a completely unnecessary stress. And it shouldn't take this to make mistakes be rectified.
And it is a vital link for access to health for many, but it also is an incredibly important link for people getting into the Northwest and the connectivity between inbound flights, you know, for people travelling on to Donegal. I mean, you look at the schedule, you're planning where you might go, you go, you know, there's eight of you going golfing, right? You might say, oh, there's fantastic golf courses in Donegal, but we're not going to make that connecting flight. Let's go to Kerry because there's four or five flights down there. It's also got a beautiful reputation. You know, so there's a huge impact too on the potential, potentially in tourism.
I mean, the flight is critical in the sense that if we had a train line and if we had a six-lane motorway, you could maybe see an argument why, you know, it's not necessary. But without them things, this is the only bit of infrastructure that the government invests in, or transport infrastructure that the government invests. So give us the other things first, and then maybe we can talk about reducing the flight to two.
Yeah, and Greg, if you don't mind, you've touched on a very valid point there, Seamus, in relation to the connectivity piece, and that's why the public service obligation is in place, because Donegal is more than 4 hours away from the capital, and therefore it is allowed for and funded under EU legislation. We all have a tendency sometimes to focus maybe only on money and funding and finances, and that is certainly a very important aspect of it. But with this particular case, the common sense around even where the plane is going to be saturated overnight. Previously, it was always overnighted in Donegal so that you were certain that it was going to leave Donegal Airport in the morning and head to Dublin. Now it's been proposed that the plane would overnight in Dublin. And that creates massive uncertainty for the cancer patients, for people who are going to Dublin for other forms of treatment, for people who are going maybe getting connecting flights, business people that are going to London or wherever for connecting flights. If that plane isn't sitting there in Carrickfinn Airport overnight and into the morning, and they're sitting in Carrickfinn wondering and waiting and hoping and praying that it'll leave Dublin. And that there could be any number of reasons why that wouldn't happen.
But also, too, the knock-on effect is that we have good relationships with hospitals down there. They're not going to play ball with appointments if there's uncertainty. Emma Gova, very interested in your views on this as well, of course.
Well, you know, it is not a luxury, as Piers Doherty has said, and as Fionnan, I think, has said. I'm not one to misquote you there, Fionnan, but it isn't a luxury. It is an absolute lifeline for people in Donegal. I mean, we don't have the rail service, and at times, as a parent of a wheelchair user, we don't have accessible buses. So the reality is that if we take this away, and I say we, you know, not only we're adding expense to families as well in a time that is already very financially strenuous for people. And the last thing they should have to be worrying about is, can they afford an overnight in Dublin? And, you know, these patients, these cancer patients are going through rigorous treatments, and we're going to then subject them to a 4-hour drive home after having these treatments. It's just completely unacceptable. And what I can't understand is, if you look at the CSO figures, 50,530 passengers used Donegal Airport in 2024 compared to the 41,867, which was an increase of 21%. So why would you then reduce the service if the numbers are climbing?
And
the
thing is, because this tender sat, as far as I understand, right, this tender sat there and it's been renewed. And as I say, I'm looking for information on this. And it kind of was down to the discretion of the airline that they put on the flights that they did. And no one sort of said, right, this is coming up for tender again. What's there is working. We need to adjust this tender to ensure the same level of service. That's an incredibly big oversight for my and I mean that's why I keep asking who's responsible, yeah. Because we've such a lack of accountability.
Well, you see, this is the problem, isn't it? Because it's lack of accountability. I mean, the very fact that we can't find out who signed this tender, how is anybody supposed to be held accountable if you can't find who signed it? Do you know what I mean? And it's too many oversights. You know, we see this now. And then we have to have inquiries, which cost even more money to the taxpayer, as to why this happened, like the overspend of the Children's Hospital, the bike shed, the many other overspends that have happened. And you have to ask yourself, where is the accountability here? You know, if this was in the private sector, you'd be long gone.
The thing,
and that's just the reality.
People listening might think that we've a funny way of doing things in this country, in that we have relatively successful areas. So say, for instance, let's throw this flight in there, farming and fishing, if I could put it like that. And then you introduce stuff that makes it very hard to do those things. And then the productivity or the practicality drops. And then you use that as an argument to say, well, listen, we need to diversify. Farming's on its knees. Fishing's on its knees. We need to diversify. The amount of people using that flight has gone from 55,000 to 32,000. We need to scrap the PSO. I hope that's not what's going on, Emma.
Well, I sincerely hope not. But here's the thing, you know, the numbers have gone up. But the reality is that you know, it's going to affect tourism, as you've said. And, you know, you look at the likes of the Rathopenna Golf Course, Ballyliffin Golf Course, all of those who rely on tourism as well as the locals to keep them going. And, you know, we're already in a cost of living crisis. This could cost jobs as well. And we need to, there's a petition at the moment online, as Fiona mentioned. It was not started by me. It was started by, I believe, a woman called Maria McFadden. And I would heavily encourage everybody to go online and sign it. I know people say, oh, what do petitions do? But at the end of the day, it lets them see our voice, that we are not willing to accept being cut off yet again.
Mm-hmm.
Because we're up in the Northwest, that we are not going to be paddy last every time.
All right.
Yeah, and Greg, and I would stress too, like if people are looking, you know, out in their cars this morning and they look at their tax disc and they wonder what they're paying the same level of road tax as a user in Dublin who's got the M50 and the M1 and the users in Cork who've got all the tunnels and things to get around. You're paying the same level of taxation as the rest of the country. You've no access to the Lewis, you've no access to the Dart, you've no access to any train. You're paying the same level of tax. This is what we get compensated for. This is our service. And we should be doing everything we can to keep it.
Yeah, okay. Last word to you, Fiona.
Could I make one final and related point? And it's a number of people have contacted me throughout the week about the new Derry to Dublin PSO service, with concern now about what impact, you know, this will have on that service. Or is it a case that somebody is trying to replace the Donegal Dublin with the Derry to Dublin service? But I really do want to knock that completely and totally on the head. That's not the case. They're two totally separate public service obligations with separate funding streams, and there is no connection between them, and one won't negatively impact on the other. They'll complement each other, actually, and hopefully they'll both boost connectivity between this entire region and our capital.
Yeah, we're a wee bit way off that yet, because we don't really have the Donegal one as we need it, but I understand the clarification there. We're in the company of Councillor Fionnán Bradley, Emma Gova and Seamus McDade, and we will be speaking, I think, in the towards the end of the second hour to Deputy Piers Doherty, who also raised the issue of the proposed changes to the PSO schedule at Donegal Airport. And he was in conversation or in an exchange with his sparring partner in the Dáil, Simon Harris, and seemingly Simon Harris spoke favourably to the need for a PSO that actually serves the region. So we shall see. While being questioned in the Oval Office about Jeffrey Epstein's survivors, President Trump deflected the inquiry by labelling CNN's Caitlin Collins the worst reporter, repeatedly telling her she never smiles. Now, most women have been told to smile at least once in their careers, usually when they're just trying to do their jobs. Well, when President Donald Trump says it to a reporter, is he just being old school, or is it a reminder that women are still expected to look pleasant, even when they're asking the tough questions? Emma, I feel drawn to you.
Could that be because I'm the only woman on the panel? When you're a star, they let you do anything. You can grab them by the genitals. Now, I have used a more polite word than the now president used at the time of the 2016 election. I think we are doing old school men a disservice by even suggesting that he's just old school. This is a man with 34 felony convictions for fraud, for paying hush money to Stormy Daniels, I believe her name is, before the 2016 election. And he was also found liable for sexually assaulting and defaming a writer called E. Jean Carroll. So, no, I don't think that he's just been old school. I think he is misogynistic. I think he has a history of being predatory. And I think that it's a distraction when he's been asked about Epstein to then go back to what the woman looks like. And you know what? I remember once somebody handed me, not a compliment, but at the time, you know, and you have to take it on the chin and just say, okay. I remember somebody saying to me, I've heard you on the radio a couple of times. And I said, oh, thanks very much. He said, you have a great face for radio.
Wow, what a lovely thing to say.
And I just had to take it on the chin.
But that be, now, here's the thing. I get that said to me all the time.
Right, but the thing is, if you look at the likes of female politicians across Ireland, the island of Ireland, 75% of politicians have said that they have been harassed and intimidated in some way. And disproportionately, it's women.
Yeah.
With things like deep fake videos being made of them.
I saw
comments being made
yeah,
them online.
Do you know, like, I'm not always exposed to that, right? For A, I'm not on the receiving end, and B, you don't always see these comments. But I did see a post, Luke Littler recently won, he's a darts player, he recently won the World Open, and there was a picture of him on stage with his girlfriend and the trophy. And this was on Facebook, right? Everyone goes on about X this and all. And I'll tell you one thing, and these are people with public accounts, the amount of fat shaming of this girl, who is by no means a big girl, don't get me wrong, and if she was, it doesn't matter either. But fellas, and if you looked at the profile picture, these were no oil paintings, right? But publicly criticizing her appearance in the most horrendous and vile manner, and I must have scrolled 50 comments, and there was over 400 comments, and then I just gave in. I thought, is there going to be an end to this? So you're right, you know, it's not, and it doesn't have to be a famous person. The objectification and judgment is horrendous.
I remember a video being uploaded of me talking about disability services to one of your colleagues, and somebody else had recorded it and put it on TikTok. And instead of realizing that we were talking about really important respite services for children with disabilities, the things that were said were she's too overweight to be a carer, so she couldn't work that hard. She transgender. She looks like Sam Smith. You know, it was more about what I looked like as opposed to the message we were trying to deliver. And that's why women don't want to go into public office. I'll just be honest and say that. That's why women don't want to go into politics. The amount of times people have asked me to go into politics and I say I won't do it because not only will I not expose myself to that, I won't expose my children to that.
Yeah, but back to the start of the question then. So, and I don't really want to focus on Trump. I just thought it an interesting thing to bring into the conversation. Is that not the reality, that he is so cantankerous and old and of the character that he is, that he feels he can say those things out loud? So in other words, he's just saying out loud in a public forum what your lived experiences. You know, you've been the victim, like Caitlin Collins has.
It's because nobody's holding him to account. We see that too with, like, Siobhan Madigan has said that female sports broadcasters are often viewed as intruding in the male domain. We've seen it with a GAA reporter, Eamon Killahan, who said that laddish behaviour is a common thing she faces and she just has to take it on the chin and just take the lewd comments as they come. At the end of the day, you know, it's a horrible thing to say, and I'm not trying to be hateful to you. I'm sure you've experienced many things, but the idea, but there is an appearance bias that can lead women to being deemed less competent if they're too pretty, like the blonde effect when they're in work, that they're too pretty to be competent. And yet if you try to tone it down, then you're not attractive. So you get
conversely,
overlooked anyway.
I watched a TikTok of a woman who has a big bum, right?
Okay.
And she said that she can't, she thinks it's holding her back. Like, she can't wear clothes to conceal it, right? But she feels that she's not taken seriously in the workplace because of it. Like, this is someone quite in mid-level professional life, so it's not like a thirst trap or anything. This was a genuine thing, like.
Yeah. I have an acquaintance who applied for, she was a journalist, and she then went and she had children. She took some time out of work, but she would be older now. And she applied for a job on the radio, and she did brilliantly on her verbal interview. And then when she went to the face-to-face interview, the person interviewing her said, "I thought you were younger by your voice." And she knew she was never getting a call back.
Yeah. I suppose, Seamus, you know, like, I'm kind of, you tend to be insulated if you're not affected by, you know, women being judged on their appearance, being expected to smile. You know, we know in this, and President Trump is not, of course, an example of men, but sometimes it actually gets the conversation going because that's what women have to put up with. I suppose the best place is to try and avoid that in the workplace.
Yeah, I mean, I think Emma spoke very eloquently there about what, you know, what women have to face. And I agree. I think, you know, taking any sort of lessons in civility from President Trump is a very bad idea. So he is on the most extreme of the extreme scale.
Can I say something before you continue your point? And I've seen this before when a Irish politician turned on a journalist in this country. Where was the backing of her in that room? Like, these are, and I'm losing faith in journalism, and I have been for a long time as a consumer, let me say. Like, where was the, excuse me, I have a follow-up question on that from a fella to see if Trump would try and bat him off with the same sort of commentary. You know, I was very, very disappointed that no other journalist would stand up in that situation, or in the Irish example, and sort of say, hold on a second, you can't speak to someone like that.
Well, I suppose, I mean, Greg, I guess I would actually like to hear your opinion that you've been in the press pack, you've seen what it's like. I mean, I know there was an example at the start of the year in Ireland with, I can't remember the politician name, but she's from People for Profit, and she did have a go at a journalist, and the other journalists did back that journalist. But I don't know what happens in this, but I mean, James McLean refused to speak to a journalist on Saturday night, and the other journalists, the national journalists in Solidarity, wouldn't interview McLean.
There is a local example of this situation.
Yeah,
because
it is a local, I'll just be stressed and say James McLean might have been right to not speak to that journalist.
Yeah, I don't mind politicians or sports people choosing, like, say, for instance, not to speak to the Sun newspaper, for an example, right, because of its history of reporting on Hillsborough, etc. I don't think that's what the situation is with James McLean, don't get me wrong, but it's how maybe that journalist framed his comments about being an Irish Republican, for an example. So I get that, but it's just this public humiliation with no one else sort of saying, like, I'll back you on this anyway. But sure,
it must be incredibly lonely for the person, all right, to have to suffer that. But I suppose this is, I mean, you're right. It lacks, the other people who didn't defend or lack character, and their argument will be, if we stand up, we'll lose access.
Yeah, that's it.
Are we doing our job?
Yeah.
But you're lacking character then by doing that.
Of course, Fionn, I suppose too, when we have and. There's this perhaps misconception that because the council is majority fellas that women don't get a look in. We all have wives and sisters and partners and all manner of things. So I presume women's issues are to some degree represented. But when you have less than 8-7% of women on a local authority the size of Donegal County Council, I suppose it's not a big reach to see how we end up having conversations like this when there's such a lack of female involvement in politics.
Yeah, and look, listen, Donegal is the bottom of the pile and the bottom of the pack when it comes to female representation on the council. We have three out of the 37 councillors, and that is terrible. There's no sugarcoating it. But I have to say, Greg, I have to say, within the chamber, and listen, the debate and the argument gets up on a daily basis whenever you're in Lifford. I've never ever seen any example of misogyny towards any of the female elected
Well,
members.
thankfully, in this council, but I've been at meetings where it was completely evident. But of course, you can only speak of the current council.
Yeah, I honestly would have no knowledge now of anything that happened before my time
Yeah, of
on the
course.
council, which is June 24. But thankfully, I've never seen any example of it, and I can tell you for certain that I wouldn't tolerate it, and I don't think anybody else would either. But America and the US of A, it's a different world, and I'm not saying that in any way to make an excuse, but they really do seem to have different standards when it comes to interviews and the type of the type of lashback that is accepted from politicians and from people who are being interviewed. And it's not just the journalist to the politician in terms of the relationship. If you watch even debates in any of the various forum that are in the US of A between politicians, you would never see a debate like it in Ireland, or maybe not anywhere in Europe. They're deeply, deeply personal. And that seems to be their
I
go-to
think we're
thing.
about one election away from that, personally speaking.
Well,
That's the truth.
listen, look, it is quite possible, but I mean, I'd be watching various debates from the House of Representatives or the US Senate or any of the congressional hearings about any number of things, and I'd just be gobsmacked, at how it's all conducted. And I think, well, thank God, bad and all as it is here, that it's not like that. One other point I would make, and it's an absolutely no way to make an excuse for Trump, but this is interesting to me. Trump isn't a politician by nature. He's not molded as a politician. You might call him an accidental politician or an opportunist politician or whatever. Is from my earliest age, I always remember being deeply interested in politics and living, breathing, eating, and sleeping it and wanting to know all about it. Whereas Trump is very, very, very late to the game. So the point I'm making is, I don't think when it comes to a political question and as a politician, that is any at all in relation to that. I don't think he's built up any experience or that he's used to it. And being interviewed in business, I'm sure as Seamus would agree, is totally, totally different to being interviewed in politics. And you do sort of build up, call it what you want, a sort of coping mechanisms for difficult questions. And the question that was posed to Trump about Epstein and the survivors, I don't think Trump has any form of coping except to lash out in the way that he did. But that's just an observation as someone who maybe grew up around politics, watching on at
Yeah,
somebody
but I
who's
mean,
just
like, okay, we've seen it then. If, to follow through your point, that's fine. But he's saying it in the boardroom then as well. In that business environment. Just a couple of minutes on the subject matter. Caitlin Collins was asking him about the Epstein files, Emma. The most horrendous of stuff in these files, which you wouldn't really know by some of the American media reporting, it would seem. Massive ramifications elsewhere in the world, though. Obviously, even Keir Starmer could be on the brink of having to go as the leader of the British government. Yet in America, those most strongly implicated, it's just like, it's a hoax. You've taken my emails out of context. And because everything over there is so politically polarized, they're all getting away with it, Emma. It's really quite remarkable.
It really is. It's like, even though it's not the US, I'm talking about the UK, it's like Peter Mandelson saying, I don't remember being given $70,000 by Epstein, or £75,000. I'm not sure which one it was. I'm sure that if somebody gave me $75,000,
I know it's amazing,
I remember being given it.
but
But it's the lack of
the
accountability,
politics and the
and it's
public didn't buy that, you see. But if he was in
yeah.
America, that would have been
If
bought.
he was in America, it would be fine, because you look at the fact that, for example, the now sitting president, Donald Trump, had to pay $88 million to a woman after being found liable for sexually assaulting and defaming her. I believe he's the first president to be a felon with 34 felony charges. And the thing is that he was still elected. It's, do you know what? I think sometimes in America, on the extremes of both sides, it's almost cultish. It's like, you've seen it after the attempt on Donald Trump when they all turned up to one of his rallies with their ears covered and they had these bandages on their ears. And, you know, it's quite frightening, actually, when you think about how cultish it can be. And it's the people kind of in the middle you have to feel for. But, you know, there is no accountability. And I'm going to be honest and say to you that I think the Epstein files, from what I've read and what I've seen, is absolutely horrific and horrendous what these girls went through and what these people were allowed to do simply because of their status. It shouldn't matter, actually, to be honest, what their status was. What these girls went through was horrendous, but I can honestly tell you, I don't think that there will be any accountability. I think the people that were involved in this in Hollywood and, you know, your billionaires who own masses of amounts of property and businesses will not be held to account. This will just be another Me Too scandal that everybody talks about for a while. Mm. And then it goes away. And that's very, very sad for the girls whose lives were ruined. You see this with Prince Andrew. Well, he's not Prince Andrew anymore. Sorry, he's Andrew Mountbatten Windsor. Now, I actually do think that they've done a progressive thing by taking the titles from him, but I don't think that's enough. I think he should be highly encouraged to go before Congress. But let's be honest here, folks. What's going to happen with these people going in front of Congress and testifying in front of Congress?
Well, it puts it on the record, and I think that's always important. But he could face criminal charges yet. Seamus, it is bizarre watching on, isn't it? You know, Trump supporters, Trump himself, for years and years and years were campaigning for the release of these files. Eventually they are released, but too much is released, and now all of a sudden it's backing off. This is a Democratic hoax, there's nothing in there, blah, 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 blah. And unfortunately, the great thinkers of the United States, the voting public, seem to be buying it hook, line, and sinker.
Yeah, I mean, there is a great irony that Trump was the one who really trumpeted for the release of the Epstein files, and that he would be so heavily involved in them. And I just think I spent last week in New York. They're just so polarized in America right now, and like Emma said, it is just cultish that even people, you know, there would be a large percentage of the population there who voted for Trump, who really don't like Trump, but who just didn't want to vote for the other side. But at a certain point, you have to take your own individual responsibility and say, but then you are endorsing this man and everything that comes with him. Mm. And you know, and it's just, they are just incredibly polarized. The Epstein files are an incredible look through into how the world at that certain high level operates. I mean, the idea that Peter Mandelson would be coming out of cabinet meetings and telling a financier in New York what was going on, who to then be able to make money from that, but then follow through for Mandelson to get a cushy job then at a big bank, and then after that for the British government to hire him again, tells you all kind of you need to know about the.
What worries me though is what goes on that we don't know. We happen to find out what happens in big business, big politics, big entertainment. Right. You know, they live a somewhat completely different life. One question, asking for a friend, did they go through your social media before your trip to New York? Is that a thing?
Well, so I always...
Now, you've nothing to hide, don't get me wrong.
As a man who has had a lot of visas in the United States over the years, I'm sure my social media has been critiqued. You've always had to declare your social media on your ESTA. It's always been for as long as I can remember, that box has always been there.
Yeah.
And it has always said optional. Now, it still says optional. Whether it's really optional or not is debatable. So I don't know if they did, but they let me in anyway. So
okay, well, as I say, there's nothing terribly controversial there, I'm sure.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Okay. Now, there might be hot takes on Newcastle United Football Club. That might be about as bad as it gets.
No one's interested in that. Fionn, this lack of accountability in public life, we're quite familiar with it here, not in relation to this type of stuff, but certainly in America, there's everyone's seemingly going to get away with everything.
Yeah, and it does a massive disservice to politics and politicians everywhere. It really, really does. Now, politicians, by the nature of the offices that all of us hold, are held to much higher levels of scrutiny than the ordinary average public, and so we should be. And I mean, I have no problem with that. But again, back to the point about America, it's just been a different world. What seems to be acceptable, and as you said, it looks as if many very high profile and very influential and powerful people in America are going to get away with a lot of what happened. That is shocking, but it's just telling of the world that we live in now, and of where we're at. And I think, back to the interview and the piece, the interaction between Trump and the reporter, what was lost in all of it was the very topic of the interview and the question
Well,
itself,
that, but
and
that,
the
that, but you
survivors.
talked about how he's not experienced as a politician. I think he actually really is because he shut it down completely. And, that's what politicians can do. I have to take a break. A caller says, read the airport, and they can find millions for Ukraine, yet cannot fund a small airport. It's really important in this day and age, especially too when perhaps maybe you don't always get the truth or both sides from the media, that we think for ourselves. The PSO for Donegal Airport, €17 million, that money is there, that money has been allocated. The airport receives funding on an annual basis from the state in the millions of euros, and it's never been as successful as it is now. The issues as it relates to flights from the airport or to and from the airport is not about availability of money. It's about a tender, the interpretation of a tender, and the preferred tender being selected with flights that actually don't suit the people of the Northwest. It's got nothing to do with whatever money might be going to Ukraine. And as I say, in the absence maybe of critical and balanced reporting out there, it's ever more important that we truly think for ourselves and not maybe just say something that we've read on social media. I just note some figures that came out there showing that, we've got record levels of borrowing in this country. 200 million, is it 200 million in personal loans borrowings recently? Obviously, we see Bitcoin crashing, gold and silver even on their way down. Just wondering, from a business person's perspective, Seamus, do you sort of feel that there's any danger that we're kind of in that sort of recession cycle?
Well, it's really, really difficult to judge, Greg, in the sense that the hospitality industry is definitely really suffering, but other parts of the economy seem to be being pretty strong. So it's very hard to know. Personal debt is probably going to grow in Ireland as we get more credit card companies and things coming here. Mm. And just even the standard of cars on the road, it just looks better than it looked 20 years ago.
Yeah, well, so most of it is car loans, it has to be said.
Yeah, so, and it's, again, you come back from the States where everything is a new car. That's kind of how we're getting now here. I think that's probably, but is that a good thing for our economy? It's maybe debatable because if people can't afford, it might be a good thing for our economy, but it might be a bad thing for our society because if people can't actually afford these repayments and if they're stretching themselves, we'll see. I can't absolutely say that we're at the start of any sort of a downturn because, as I say, there are sectors in the economy that are very strong, but the hospitality sector is one that you're seeing serious decline.
Yeah, new figures from the Banking and Payments Federation Ireland show there were 205,000 personal loan drawdowns in the first 9 months of last year, valued over €2.2 billion. This in a cost of living crisis. I hope, Emma, we're not overstretching ourselves because, if we start seeing job losses, increased cost of living, the difficulty in paying these loans. Now, banks are better prepared for any shocks now than they were at the recession. I just hope this isn't another sign of a slippery slope.
Well, this is the issue, isn't it? And, people, especially if you're living in Donegal, you need reliable transport for a
start.
Yeah,
that's true, yeah.
Do you need to be spending maybe 60,000 a car? I don't know anybody that does, to be honest. But, with the cost of living, as you said, I mean, let's look at the price of electricity. It's just, and it is costing jobs because some businesses, especially in hospitality, they just can't afford to keep the doors open. People are taking out maybe these loans and that, and then they're losing their jobs, and then it's just snowballing, isn't it? But Are we at the start of a recession? Well, that's, I would need to ask my husband that because that's what his degree's in. He's a lot smarter than me, I'm
Right,
afraid.
I'll go
So
to
I have to
I'll go
ask
to
him.
Fionn and you can get him on the phone. Fionn, I don't know if you want a quick comment on that before we move on.
Yeah, it's hard to know what it's a sign of, Greg. I mean, as an economy,
look, I don't know where everyone's getting the money from. You know what I mean? No, that's what I just don't understand. Like, I just couldn't afford. I would love a new car.
Yeah, look,
but it's like 600 or 700 quid a month.
It is. Oh, look, it is very expensive. I think a lot of the time, Greg, are we worried about the Joneses? Are we looking, over the shoulder or looking over the fence, as the case may be?
All right, and if you put it like that, there's 205,000 Joneses, and I'm not one of them. So, yeah, I am looking over me. I'm twitching the curtains, yeah.
Yeah, and look, I mean, I think it was Seamus who yourself made the point about cars on the road. And I don't even mean brand new cars, but I mean, you would hardly see a car on the road now that's much older than 5, 6, or 7 years old. We just don't seem to be driving them. Even when we're going to buy second-hand cars, we really don't want anything that's more than 2 or 3 years old. Yeah, so I mean, obviously, with that, the cost of such vehicles is going to go up through the roof.
Nothing worse than you go to the car dealership and they turn the nose at your 171, turn the nose up at your 171. Your pride yeah, and joy in the light. Well, that's going to have to go to auction. Oh, lovely. Thank you. Right. Does any of the panel have a view on Gregory Campbell's attitude that Connolly's speech contained numerous references to Derry, but not a single mention of Londonderry? Did he disgrace himself and show a lack of hospitality and grace to the head of a country and make it all about him once again? He did, seemingly. I don't know if any of you saw that. I can stay with you, Fionn, if you want. You're nodding your head. Gregory Campbell's Gregory Campbell, though, and I'm not sure how many people he represents. Maybe it's a lot.
Well, listen, I suppose in a way we shouldn't be shocked and surprised given that it is Gregory Campbell. I mean, he's famous for this type of rhetoric. We have the curry me yogurt and the Coca-Cola episodes and all the rest of it. That said, I do feel that it was disrespectful. And I'm saying that as a politician to a politician. I can't imagine a world where I would ever meet the head of state of anywhere, whether it's my country, another country or whatever, and that I would behave in such a manner. And from the council here, I'm actually a member of the committee on constitutional change. So we're trying to plan and pave a way forward for reunification and whatever. And when I saw that video and saw the interaction yesterday, I really was down in my boots about it. I thought we really are nearly as far away as we ever have been.
Yeah, although putting it to Seamus, I don't know if you saw the comments, but I mean, at the end of the day, who is Gregory Campbell representing, really? It's ultimately himself, isn't it?
Yeah, he is. Well,
maybe not. I don't know. Yeah.
No, listen, he gets some votes, so people, he does represent some people, but it's a minority, and, I don't know if you could use him as a barometer. To
everyone I'm bringing up, you're saying these aren't barometers. They're all elected politicians, for crying out loud.
That's true.
Do you know
That's
what I mean?
True.
I'm not pulling these people in off the street.
Yeah, but I wonder, though, in both Gregory Campbell and Trump, if you gave their voters another option, would they flock to them? And I think they would.
Well, Seamus, can I take you up on that point? And I don't necessarily disagree with you, but North Antrim is the perfect example of that as a constituency, the home of Paisley, where he represented for however many decades. And in the last British general election, the DUP voters did look elsewhere, but they looked to an even more extreme option in the form of the TUV. So, yeah. In that sense, I am worried. And I mean, obviously, with the rise of Mr. Farage in London and the prospect of a reform-led government after the next general election there, I worry, is Gregory Campbell in relation to unionism, is he more representative than we're given
him credit for? And potentially could become more relevant to Emma. I sometimes have to, when I said, how representative he is of. Sometimes I tune out of people that are very sort of extreme, if you know what I mean. And maybe, this is indicative of attitudes. But respect for a head of state should always be there regardless, shouldn't it, Emma?
Absolutely, absolutely. And, here's the thing. We know where Catherine Connolly stands in United Ireland. and the reunification of Ireland. But I think he was just trying to grandstand, if I'm entirely honest. I think he was looking for them clips to be shared around.
Yeah, it is a bit of grandstanding.
And he was just looking for people to say, oh, look at him. He stood up to her and, you know, and he's trying to reach out for more votes in the future, I think. But I agree with Fiona. When you see the likes of the TV and all coming in and Reform. I mean, I dread the thought of a Reform candidate in Northern Ireland, and that's the absolute truth.
Okay. Well, unfortunately, Emma, that's where we have to leave it. Emma Gover, a.k.a. the Wee Donegal Mummy. Thank you very much indeed. Always a pleasure to have you on the programme. Fionnán, thank you very much indeed. Look after yourself. Are you waiting on a politician to come visit?
Yes, yeah, I think he may be here. We have Minister Box from Oran and the county today to discuss flood relief schemes and the like. So
we'll be covering that extensively later. Thanks very much for that. Seamus McDade, as always, thank you so much. Look after yourself.
Cheers, Greg. Thanks.
Bye-bye. Seamus Gunn of McLaughlin, Gunn, Solicitors, Letterkenny and Remelton is with me. Good morning, Seamus.
Morning, Greg. Nice to be here.
It's great to have you back on. Before we get into listeners' questions, really interested in your views on a case that was rumbling on for a wee while there, seems to be resolved, and it involves Lord of the Dance creator Michael Flatley. So what was the background to this case?
Yeah, it's been in and out of the news quite repeatedly in the past week or so, Greg, and for one big obvious reason, that in the Tree Arena last night, the Lord of the Dance, the 30th anniversary, was to open. Sell out, of course. I think that 30 years ago it began maybe in the Point, so it was coming back to its home. A big razzmatazz, obviously. It's been a terrific success worldwide. This particular show, I think, it's due to be performed in something like 260 different venues across Europe and the USA. And this group called Switzer Consulting Limited, they got involved back at 24 or so, and it seems that there was an arrangement whereby they would take over the running and the management of the show for a fee, and there was an agreement reached. It was probably a contract that was entered into, and they were to get over a five-year deal. They were to get X per month. I think it was 35K a month or so, and then increasing after a couple of years or so. But it went sour, basically, and there's been disagreements about it, and they have reservations about Michael Flatley's financial status, etc., and they wanted to disengage with him as such. So there's a legal case going on about that in the background. Meantime, this show is coming up, Ready to Rock. So by last week, they wanted to get an injunction, which initially they got an interim order preventing his inclusion in the show and contribution to it, which he then went in and correctly challenged. I think it was the judge said that his financial standing and that type of information was not of relevance to the case that was ongoing between them. And he lifted the injunction. So the show was then, at the beginning of the week, going on. As far as he was concerned, and he was still involved. And then, lo and behold, on Tuesday then, that the Switzer Consulting Group announced it was not going ahead. And hence, he has to go back into the High Court again on that afternoon, I think it was, and get an injunction to stop that interference and to get an order that the show would be proceeding, and also an order with regard to costumes and set, which were needed to perform it. So that was where it rested. And then, again, you can imagine the panic that was ongoing in the backgrounds, because I would say, like, such a production to put on is no small achievement in the first instance. And if you still have question marks about the set and the costumes on Tuesday, alarm bells would certainly be ringing. So by Wednesday then, they came to an arrangement whereby he was delivered the costumes on a new set in order that the show would go on last night in the Tree Arena. And lo and behold, I believe it did. And he came out himself at the start to this reported great applause And he said, and it's a good quote. It's been a rocky road to Dublin.
So why
so
would
the case is ongoing and will remain ongoing between them. But
okay.
At the and also just part of the agreement, it is reported, was that the costumes and set are to be returned in the state in which they were delivered by sometime today, I think around lunchtime today, to the Switzer consulting group.
But why is the Switzer consulting so interested in his finances? I presume it's the complicated way in how rights are held and who needs to be paid and all this type of stuff, right? So can you just break down that relationship? So why would Switzer consultant be so concerned of Michael Flatley's reputation in terms of paying bills, his lifestyle versus his income, etc.?
Because, well, I think that the reason given was that, and they brought in a financial advisor, a previous financial advisor, was that his credibility was somewhat alleged, tarnished in the past in dealing with promoters and in discharging, obviously, overheads, etc., in the running of big shows. And that might have an impact going forward. If you have 200 plus, 250 plus shows arranged worldwide, while Europe and the USA, those reservations, I suppose, would they at least they'd want to be calmed in the first instance. And they thought that this was extremely relevant. They were churning out all types of stuff about his background, which the judge, I think, correctly said, well, that's not really relevant to the issues within the contract. But they were saying, well, there's trouble ahead because the credibility of the individual has been questioned in the past, and that could have a very serious knock-on effect to our arrangements going forward. Now, I think they should have looked at that back in 2024 before they got involved in the first instance. They've been paid a fee for managing it, and I think that was their job, and the rest could be seen to be beyond their concern. It depends basically on the terms of the contract, but he has now said it's reported that he has terminated the agreement completely. So in the meantime, this is rumbling on, but also the show did go on and it seems to have been a great success, but there's going to be a lot more to come on.
We're in the company of our Legal Eagle. Is that that's a complimentary phrase. Is it Legal Eagle? Is it?
Well,
I just used it. I was thinking, I hope I don't want to, I'm not want to insult this man.
well, I don't mind. I've been insulted before and I will be again, hopefully. I'll be around to take them. And yeah, you just have to accept what comes of legal. I don't believe it is.
It's like high flying, isn't it? It's like a high flying.
Well, there are some legal people that are high flyers, maybe. But I don't really know.
I see you soaring through the skies of Letterkenny remote on a regular basis.
I'd like to think that would be an option. All right, yeah.
Okay.
Maybe Elon Musk would take me on one of those rocket trips. Yeah,
maybe so. Hi, Greg. Could you ask Seamus Gunn what does easement on land allow as a holder went in with digger without consent? Thank you.
Yeah, these easements are difficult and situations arise with them sometimes as a result of lack of communication. They've been around for multitude, the start of time, since maybe 14th century, maybe when England, the common law, and then they were formally probably adopted in the Prescription Act of around 1830s or so. There are different types of easements. So that's the first point, I think, and you have to be careful about what type of easement we are referring to. If it's such an easement that is accessed by way of a right of way, that allows an individual to make use of an access to get to their own property. And then there's terms like servient tenement and dominant tenement that come into it. So to break that down simply, if you're passing over someone else's land, the land that goes over is the servient tenement, and that serves the land or a house. That's the dominant tenement in it. Now, if one has a right to carry out certain works, there could be an easement for. There could be an easement that allows, for example, putting in utilities such as water, electricity, which could mean that would be required underground. And that's another specific type of easement as to use for utilities. There could be a conservation restriction order. And you see these SACs now, which are special amenity areas of conservation, which actually restrict the land from being developed, and rightly so, around the coastlines of Ireland. They're quite common. The point, though, that I think that has caused some angst here is the individual refers to a digger going in without consent. And this is where we come back down to what something that we reference here many times, right, is communication with people. You know, if something is required to be done out of necessity or whatever, and there is correct communication and everything is left back as it was pre any works, and there is a right to go on a property to do that, that should be resolvable with some dialogue. It's where there isn't communication, it can get very, very difficult. It's also where one sees that, well, maybe they have a right to pass over a particular property, but they don't have a right to go and dig anything up. And that's so that easement is restricted, and that will be taking liberties. And that's where you get into a very, very tricky area and title actions and heading down the route of the circuit court. So you want to get proper advice as to what is the easement you actually have, and stick within that. If you go beyond that, if you don't have agreement from the other party, well, then you're going to have an issue, and rightly so. So that's a broad run of the types of issues that can arise, and also the types of easements that are out there. And as I say, it's important that you maybe in these situations that you do get some legal advice before you start moving with machinery, etc.
Yeah, I think too many of us rely, though, on seeking forgiveness rather than permission. We were talking.
Yes, well, yeah, I think I know a fair. It's a very fair point that it is a very fair point, but that is, to be fair, taking a serious liberty.
Of course, it is.
With
It's not
some, you
right.
know,
Yeah, it's not
but
right.
it can be sometimes the modus operandi.
Yeah.
It's not the right one legally.
Yeah, of course. We were talking, I think it was the last time we were on, about being filmed in public and that being repurposed. And just a follow-up question in relation to this, and it's one I'm interested in, because, you know, you go to a pub, or you go to a where there's music being played,
It
and
could
you know,
probably happen to you, so it could, you know, when
well,
you're out and about, you know.
but
Yeah.
potentially, you see, this is what I'd be
Yeah.
concerned about. But you could go out and have a dance, you know, you've had a few sherbets, the limbs are loosening up, right? And there's an awful lot of videoing goes on in these premises. Often it's done by the owners of the premises, but I also note too, on TikTok, there's a few pubs that stream the inside of the pub live all of the time for whatever reason. So the listener wanted to know, hello, Greg, what about videoing at a dance? Is that legal if you then put it up on Facebook?
Well, yeah, it's a very, very broad question, Greg. You've touched on loads of strands. You've touched on the rights. One of the biggest ones, rights we all have, is the right of privacy, and it has to be guarded and protected right from the Constitution down. With social media, everything is being diluted, and maybe referencing what you mentioned earlier on, is apologise maybe later on and say, oh, we didn't know that's the situation. So if you're going to go streaming, first of all, the question I was asking is it illegal to video a dance? Well, my view in on that is it's not illegal to actually take a video at a dance, but you stray slightly then into the realms of, well, if you're going to put that and you're going to publish that, and you're going to put it up on Facebook or some of the other social media platforms, or even all of them, what's the story then? Well, I would consider that if you're taking that step, you're going to have to be able to identify the persons in it, and you should appropriately seek their consent before doing so. Now, if you don't do that, they could make an application or whatever to that particular platform to take that down. They could also make a point to the Data Protection Commissioner, and they could make the claim, certainly make the claim, that if you're taking this type of action and you're publishing it, well, then you're a keeper of records under the General Data Protection legislation, so you're in breach of GDPR.
There you go.
And the
Okay.
individual would have the right actually to challenge you under that, and maybe make an appropriate report to the Data Protection Commissioner. And there can be very heavy penalties that follow on that. But in the first instance, it's a public place, and it happens all the time that people video, etc. But if you go then further and take that step whereby you are intruding in a person's privacy by putting something up on social media that they're not in agreement with or they don't know anything about, well, then I think you're straying into becoming a data protection
and I think particularly controller. I think in particularly maybe venues that shoot these videos without express permission, they're rolling the dice a little bit. I mean, you know, they get away with it, but it only might take a challenge.
If you were asking me to advise them on that, I'd be saying, well, you know, you're now a keeper of data. The individuals that are on that technically now could say, well, look, we want to see it, first of all, before you put it up. We're entitled to that. And if you go ahead and you publish that or put it up on some of the social media platforms, we'd be making an application to have it taken down. And also then we'd be referring the matter to the Data Protection Commissioner. And then it will definitely get difficult, and it will get expensive because they'll have to then engage some of those higher legal eagles that you mentioned, the reference earlier on, to get involved.
Okay. This is an interesting question, though. I think the answer might be quite simple. I don't know. If a joint will was made and one person has passed away, is the other person, the surviving signatory, I suppose you would call it, is the other person under the power of attorney, i.e., says the listener, can they change that will?
Well, as the phrase, the question, these are, I think, what I would describe as mutual wills, which are very common and they work very well in lots of situations. So that's basically a scenario where a husband and wife make a will, leaving everything to each other in the first instance. In the first instance, and I think that's important just to put a little bit of emphasis on that. And then they simultaneously, they could put in place an alternative that if one predeceases, then this is what they want to happen. X, Y, and Z, maybe a point. The different executors could be the same, and then leave their estate as they see fit. And both may agree on that at that particular time. This is where the issue, I think, arises here on this one, is that one has now passed away. On the passing of that individual, the estate then, as per the will, goes to the survivor. So spouse inherits. Now the question is, are they bound by the alternative scenario that they both signed into whenever they made the wills in the first place? Well, the answer to that is I believe they are not. That then the estate, they own it in their own right. And at that point, they can make new arrangements. So that should be discussed in advance as to are they going to follow through on that. But remember this, that circumstances change. When a husband or and wife or partners or cohab partners make wills, leaving everything to each other in the first instance, as time goes on, maybe many years go by and they don't look at them again, even maybe if there was children or dependents, they might have made arrangements. But then they've grown up, they've moved away, and you know maybe one's living at home. So circumstances have changed dramatically. Mm. So one spouse inherits the lot, and then they say, well, this arrangement no longer fits the situation. So therefore, they're quite entitled to go ahead.
Yes, but say, for instance, it was you and I, Seamus, now were to get married, OK, and we did a joint will and I was to die and then you rewrite the will to disinherit my children. I think that's the kind of space maybe this caller might be coming from. But can you put a provision in a will to say, in the event that I die first, I would like such and such to happen?
The will is a singular document, Greg.
Yeah.
They're not two documents. So this is my last will and testament, hereby revoking all former wills and our other testamentary dispositions at any time made by me. So if I die first, these are my arrangements. They're the arrangements that are in place. Mm. So and if I die first, I am leaving everything to my partner. So and so be it. That's because otherwise it's non-effective. It shouldn't be effective.
True. Yeah, exactly.
Couldn't be effective at all. So they're the last person, and therefore, so. But you could have a situation if it's talked out as to putting alternative scenarios in place, of course. But if you take this, if in the first place you leave everything to one party, when that person dies, that party then succeeds. So now the point you're making, yes, But you would have to address that at the time of both making the arrangements at that point in time as to what like I have seen situations where maybe there's two different families coming into it, maybe people being divorced or whatever, partners that come involved, come with two different families. Sometimes they make provision, each makes provision for their own in those type of circumstances. So that can all be discussed and trashed out. But the question is though, the net point is, can they make new arrangements? And the answer is yes, if
Yes.
that's the way it's set up, yes.
Okay. I think this is a question that a lot of people might be interested in the answer to, Seamus. So the caller owns land and the County Road water is running down the hill and onto their land, and it's causing damage to this land in bad weather. So who is responsible for this damage? So I'm presuming what the implication here is the water is not being controlled. It's running down the county road. It's not being, directed into a drain or a shock or whatever it might be. And it's coming down off the county road and straight into this person's land and causing damage to it.
And look, if you look around the country, go south now, and you see all these issues and floodplains, etc. You could be saying the local authority are maybe to blame because they don't have right protections in place in the first instance to cater for these type of terrible circumstances. But and if you're out on the road, sometimes you come across and you can nearly waterplane on the roads with the water gushing down or coming off lands. And what's the responsibility of the local authority? Well, first of all, water will get to sea level. Like that's natural, and there is natural drainage. And if traditionally that has been its route, unfortunately, it may not have been properly catered for as developments happen. And this is where the problem usually arises, is that somewhere along the line, the old traditional route of the drainage is upset to some degree, and that there's a bigger volume passing in a particular direction, and that can cause, obviously, can cause flooding, can cause inconvenience, can cause nuisance. So you have to, first of all, identify the source, identify who's responsible, and that also probably put your hand in your pocket and get an engineer's report to work out, and traditionally then check out records to see what was the original natural drainage for this particular area. And then armed with that, of course, you can discuss it. The local authority would be very, I'd say, very good at addressing any issues that's within their control. But what I'm saying is, first of all, you have to identify who's responsible. And that's, I think you have to start with the engineers.
And you know what? In all developments, it's what then can happen downstream. We've seen it in Strabane with development in Lifford. We see it in Letterkenny, where you take away natural seepage, you concrete and tarmac the entire side of a hill. What happens next if you don't properly control that water? It's fascinating.
Natural drainage applies, and water has to get to sea level, So,
Seamus, look after yourself. Thank you so very much for your time. It's always a pleasure. If anyone wants
thanks,
any
Grant.
more details, obviously the office is in Remelton and Letterkenny, and also online, of course.
Yes, Greg, we are online,
Excellent. You checked it this month.
donegallslisteners.ie,
No,
gun.ie,
normally there's a bit of
and
uncertainty, but you checked it this month, obviously.
24. I always check it before I come on to be sure we still are.
To make sure you paid the servers. That's done.ie. Okay, thanks very much indeed. Look after yourself. Thanks for all the comments coming in this morning. They're very much appreciated. Greg, what happens to ballot papers after an election is held? I don't think I've ever heard anyone talking about it. The reason I ask is that I think in America, the way they were going to look at ballots from the 2020 presidential election, or maybe they keep them over there. Well, my understanding is that they are sealed after the election here, and they're kept for 6 months. And if there's no challenge, or if there's no question over the result of the election, they're destroyed then after 6 months. So we retain them, or we're obliged to retain them for 6 months here. Who would want ones like Gregory Campbell in a United Ireland and Jim McAllister? Well, that's a situation that's going to be have to be overcome. As far as I'm aware, Gregory Campbell has an Irish passport. Greg, actually, three of the prominent politicians involved in the Good Friday Agreement are named in Epstein files: President Bill Clinton, Peter Mandelson, and Senator George Mitchell. Indeed, that is quite true. But I was talking about it from a local perspective, but I understand where you're coming from. It's Derry City and Strabane District Council, not Londonderry City Council. The city is called Derry officially. Okay, and you've got the Apprentice Boys of Derry as well. They're not the Apprentice Boys of Londonderry, are they? And on it goes. Keep them coming in. I'll get to more of them between now and 11. I'm joined on the programme now by Sinn Féin's finance spokesperson, Donegal Deputy Piers Doherty. Good morning to you, Piers. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Greg. Thank you.
OK, there's going to be a slight delay because your signal, well, it's slightly improved there now. Piers, you raised the issue of the PSO, Donegal to Dublin, Dublin to Donegal flights. The concerns, you know, are well rehearsed now on this programme. Obviously, you know, inbound traffic for tourism, but of course, too, this vital health link for people of Donegal. Before we get to that, I'm trying to ascertain how we set up this tender that allowed for an airline to propose these flights and for that to be aligned to the tender. In other words, that their submission would be accepted. They'd be the preferred applicant. How did we allow that to happen?
Yeah, I think that's where there's a major mistake here, Greg, in relation to this, that the state has sent out a tender asking for twice daily return flights. They only stipulate that it has to leave early in the morning and return home in the evening to Donegal, which obviously is what people want. But, you know, for decades, we've always had the midday flight. That's the way it worked. That's not stipulated in the tender. And because it's not stipulated in the tender, what Emerald Airlines have done is they've basically put on the second flight at a time when, as I said yesterday, the Taoiseach, in my view, we're going to have ghost planes. We will have, you know, I don't see a huge demand, Greg, for people wanting to get back to Donegal at 6:30 in the morning, leaving Dublin, you know, having to be out of the airport there at 5 o'clock in the morning. I don't see that demand. And I think, you know, the people of Donegal don't see that demand. It's why, you know, we've over 10,000 signatures in that petition led by the Cancer Flight Services, you know, an excellent charity that's, you know, spoke to yourselves on many occasions. And like, you know, when we talk about that, there's over 500 people that are supported through that service. That's not 500. Obviously, there's so many more that have been supported, people who have now, you know, recovered from cancer. And unfortunately, so many people who have lost their lives to cancer. But there's over 500 on the books at this point in time. They're patients, and I've spoke to some of them. As I said to the Taoiseach, like, we know people who simply are saying, I can't do a 9-hour journey, whether it's in a car or in a bus. I just couldn't do it to go to Dublin. And this flight, and it's supported, it's subsidized, but more importantly, it gets you up and down there, and it gets you up in town. You know, the group there based in the Poilaeg d'Or liaise with the hospitals and all the rest to get your treatment and get you back home at a quick time. So it is a really a lifeline. So I'm very, very annoyed at this. I'm annoyed that it's come so late in the day. These tenders were in for November of last year. This should have been flagged that this is not workable. And now we're in a situation where there is no contract at the end of this month. Nobody can book a flight, to my understanding, after the 26th of this month or the end of this month. So that's
why is that, though? I mean, has the airline not signed up to this? Are we not speaking after the fact?
There's no contract in place. So what happened was there was a 3-year contract provided that was to run out last year, and then that was extended for a year. There is now a PSO tender that has gone out last year. The bids had to be in by, I think, November. And until that contract is awarded, then, you know, an airline can operate themselves if they want to, but they will not be subsidised.
So why has the contract not been awarded yet?
Well, because there's obviously because there's discussions going on now at this stage, and we're trying to put serious pressure in relation to try and get that.
Was rumbling then out of the public eye then.
Oh, absolutely! Like the department knew about this in November. The department knew that the midday flight was gone.
Did you know?
I found out the day that I did an interview
last
on Highland
week.
Radio last week, and I was contacted by the airport as well. The airport management were on local media on that day, and that's when I found out. But and I'm very annoyed about this, because we now have a situation where what should happen is we should be telling the airline that this contract can't go ahead.
Does this not potentially work in our advantage, though, if a contract has not been signed, if the will is there?
Absolutely, absolutely. If that's the key thing, the will is there. So, you know, in a negotiation position, Greg, what you would do is when you got that tender in November, somebody with an ounce of sense would say, this is unworkable for the people of Donegal. It's a public service obligation. Yeah. We are there to serve the public, not to serve the
airline. I still can't get my head around that we just rolled the dice. We were just lucky that the airlines who were responsible for this in the past had the aeroplane in Donegal overnight that did come back at lunchtime. Like, why has that not been a stipulation? Why did we just sort of presume, well, that's the way it's always been, when we're dealing with 17 odd million euro of taxpayers' money and the lives of a community potentially?
Yeah, well, look, the option here, when you get a ridiculous proposal coming in from an airline that's unworkable, and that the state has been asked to actually fund that, like, this contract's worth 17 million euro. This isn't small potatoes here. Like, this is big, big money that the state is putting, and rightly so, putting into their pocket to subsidize flights going to Donegal because of our lack of connectivity, no dual carriageway, no motorway, no rail line. That's why we uniquely in the island of Ireland have a PSO with Dublin. So, like, but to be paying money for a flight that people don't want or people don't need is ridiculous. So what happens in a situation like this here is the department should turn around and say in November, we're not accepting that. We're going back out to tender and we're now going to stipulate, which they should have done in the first instance.
That's
Greg.
My point. That's
stipulating the midday flight. Like, if you look at the contracts for ferry services on the off Donegal, in those contracts it stipulates where the boat has to be overnight. You know, so like this is really crucial because the airplane should be in Donegal Airport as it always has been overnight. And the reason being is because, unfortunately, 8% of all flights last year were actually delayed more than 30 minutes. When we talk about delayed, they are actually flights that ended up being cancelled. The risk now increases significantly when the plane is not even in Donegal to take off in the morning, that it has to get down from Dublin and then has to take off again. So the risk is seriously increased.
If that flight doesn't go ahead, do the airlines still get paid?
I'm not 100% sure on that. What I can tell you is the PSO, which I think also is ridiculous, allows for 10% of cancellations or flights that are delayed more than 30.
And out of Dublin Airport, you've got plenty of excuses for 10% between access to takeoff slots, weather. We heard, you know, whatever it might be, the weather over Donegal is not suitable to land, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah, 2% of the times it's weather, of the 2% of the 8 times, that 8% that it didn't land on time is weather, and 6%
mechanical.
Is technical.
Okay.
Deputy Pat the Cope Gallagher met with the airline in relation to this here. Now, they didn't give any indication that they were changing the midday flight to that, and I'm also annoyed at them in relation to this. But look, we need to find a way forward.
And so in relation to that, right, because everyone's saying the right thing seemingly. I think Simon Harris did sound sympathetic to this situation. Pat the Cope Gallagher says he's speaking to Dara O'Brien, bish, bash, bosh, all of that stuff. There's not a contract in place at the moment. So where are we at? This is an official process as well. Right, so we have a tender, and we have a someone who has applied to that. I can't remember the exact terminology. It's too late in the morning. I haven't eaten. But anyway, they could say, "Well, listen, that was the terms of the tender. That's our submittance. You're legally bound now to give us that, aren't you?" I don't know. So how do we resolve this? Because if the airline they're a business, they could hold out and say, "Right, 24 million, and we'll do the afternoon flight." So where how do we? Look, how do we look after the interests of taxpayers' money, but also find a resolution?
Yeah, so the first thing is the department don't have to accept the tender. That makes no sense. That's the first thing. The problem is if they don't accept the tender, there's no service from the end of the month. That's a big problem, and that's why they should have acted back in November, and that's why I'm furious in relation to this here. But this is going to end up being a 4-year contract. There is no way that the Donegal can be left without midday service for 4 years. There's no way that we will allow this to happen and abandon cancer patients and other patients who are travelling up to Dublin and need this service. It's not about convenience. It is literally a lifeline for them. So we need a bit of cop on. We need a bit of common sense. You know, we're pushing and trying to put serious pressure in terms of the government. It's their decision at the end of the day. I know Boxer Moore is down in the county. He'll be joining myself tomorrow. Deputy Gallagher will be with him, and a number of people who lead that charity in terms of the cancer flights will be there as well. We'll get in the ear of Boxer in relation to this year. We're pushing every one of the pressure points we can. I've reached out to the airline to see if we can get a bit of common sense in terms of the airline, because it doesn't suit the airline either. These seats are subvented, but the airline needs to sell the seats.
Yeah, but that's why it doesn't make sense why they would put them on when they put them on, because they have knowledge of that, you know, and then we have 55,000 passengers last year. What if it's 27 under this new contract? And then they go, well, we can't justify the expense. Who's to say where it goes? Okay, well, we'll keep track of that meeting tomorrow. Pierce, thank you very much for your time. That's Deputy Pierce Doherty, Sinn Féin Finance spokesperson. Fiala Molloy's president of the Irish Natural and Hill Farmers Association. And he joins us with an appeal now because 55 Perth Blackface horned ewe sheep are missing in the Redcastle Drong area. Fiala, I presume this is on too high a scale for them to have escaped and to have been lost. What is the working theory here?
Good morning, Greg. And I just want to thank you most sincerely for giving us the opportunity to highlight this issue. Yeah, these sheep have gone missing. They were last seen on the 3rd of February at around midday. Now, the area has been checked today and there's still no sighting of them. It's presumed that they were stolen because the sheep were actually born and reared on this area and they were being fed this last number of weeks, so the likelihood of them straying would be small. So it is presumed that they've actually been stolen. Now, these sheep belong to a young family, and it's causing a huge stress and anxiety.
Well, to put it into context, it's like someone pulling into Letterkenny Main Street, hooking up a small business onto the back of a trailer and driving off with it. These are valuable. This is a business. This is a livelihood that's been stolen here.
Yeah, very much so. And as, because of the fact that it's a young family, it's a greater significance for them. So we were just making an appeal that for anybody that might have any information to get in contact with the Gardaí and its own Cairn Donna area. Our objective would be to get the sheep returned. There's no other issues around that, and for the family to actually be fit to progress, because as you say, from an economic point of view, it's going to have a massive impact on this family over the coming year.
So it's 55 Perth black-faced horn ewes missing from the Redcastle Drong area. Blue marks on their shoulders, last seen at midday on the 3rd of February. In terms of the movement of these animals, Fiala, I presume, you know, people can maybe jog their memory. What kind of a vehicle would be required or vehicles to move this amount of livestock?
Well, you would need a fairly big trailer, because for 55 ewes, you know, most farmers would understand a 12x6 deck trailer. So it would be a fairly big trailer that would be need to move them. So there's somebody, you know, is likely to have seen some activity. And it's just any bit of information that could be made available to the Gardaí to try and track down these sheep.
I'd okay, be and because of tagging and traceability and that type of stuff, is there, if they were stolen, and that's the working theory, obviously, is it more likely they are down south? Is it more likely they may have been taken into Northern Ireland?
Yeah, there's various possibilities, and that, you know, the location at this point in time could well be in Northern Ireland. And, you know, unfortunately, you know, tags can be removed. So the markings would actually be very important in that situation. So the blue on the shoulder would actually be a permanent mark on them.
Do we know if they were, you know, with lamb or...
Yeah, these ewes would have been running with the ram, so it's presumed that they would be in lamb, and that's where the costs will actually arise. You know, if those ewes lamb down, you might have 60 or 70 lambs to sell at the end of the year. If they're not found, that's a massive loss with the price that sheep are going at the moment. So, as I said, it's a really, really concerning for this young family. And that's why we're sort of putting out this appeal this morning. If anybody at all has any information, just please get in touch with the Gardaí and the Neshone, or if they want to contact Irish Nature and Hill Farmers Association head office in Tubbercurry, we can pass on information. Our only objective is try and get the sheep back for the
family. Let's make it as simple as possible. Get to the guards, but of course that other option is open. Yeah. They were last seen midday Friday the 3rd of February. So at some point this week, they were loaded into a trailer and taken away. 55 Perth black-faced horned ewes. And the wool colour is what? Just, Phelim, in case it helps.
Yeah, that would be the wool would be fairly whitish.
Okay, so it's just in case people believe them to be black. Okay, thanks, Phelim. I do appreciate it. Now, just a reminder, today is the deadline for submitting your form if you've been shortlisted for the Hospitality Awards. So if you've any problem or haven't received your form, give us a call on 07491 25000. So in other words, if you have got information back to you from word of mouth that you have been shortlisted, but you haven't received anything formally, or you haven't submitted your form, please get in touch with us. We can offer you some help in that regard. Right, we'll be back with you on Monday at 9.